Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today marks the final day of Living Arts of Tulsa's group show devoted to examining the effect development has on people and its communities. Landscaping, Development Community Effect, closes tonight with a gallery talk by one of the participating artists, documentary artist Valerie Lyman, who photographed and collected oral histories in the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota from 2013 through 2017. Her exhibit, Breaking Ground, combines her media in a very interesting way. As you walk through the gallery, her images of North Dakota and the people there are projected from all angles throughout the space, onto architectural and industrial equipment as well, and her subject stories are amplified from a set of locations. In some areas, you hear one story, in other, a cacophony of voices. But the themes are all similar, as newcomers come to this isolated place, pursuing dreams and seeking fortunes or a fresh start. In a nutshell, it's the story of booms, with deep roots here in America, be it oil, gold, or land. Valerie Lyman has an extensive background as a documentary filmmaker and has won awards for her cinematography, direction, and sound recording. She's currently a fellow at Harvard's Film Study Centers. She speaks tonight at 7 o'clock at Living Arts about her experiences in North Dakota, about her work in Breaking Ground, and her future work on this theme. I spoke with Lyman back in May when the exhibit first opened, and we repeat the conversation today on Studio Tulsa. Valerie Lyman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a really amazing installation you've created at Breaking Ground, where you spent a better part of 5 years on and off photographing and recording the people of the Bakken Shale region of North Dakota. This is around Williston, North Dakota, which has seen explosive growth and all the problems and all the opportunities that go along with it being a boom town. What drew you to the area?
I was working in Nevada, and I was filming something there. And on my day off, I went to whatever was the nearest town. And I was just so surprised walking down the town how much it looked like the sort of iconic Old West town, the way it was laid out, the fonts, I mean, everything. And I went into a bar there, and I remember saying to whoever was sitting next to me, like, this looks like a time capsule of the Old West. And he said, well, you know, you think this looks like a time capsule, you should see all these. There are abandoned mining towns around here that look exactly the way they looked the day people left them. And so that sort of piqued my curiosity. And the next time I had a chance, I took this sort of long rambling trip through a lot of the West. And I went and I started exploring and photographing these old towns. Some of them are gold, some of them are silver, some of them are coal, lumber. I mean, all these different kind of booms that we've had over the last, I don't know, century and a half. And it just really put me into this mentality of this boomtown psychology. I got really interested in it. And there were these different historical clues everywhere. I remember one town in Northern California that had like a separate graveyard for what they call the Ladies of the Night. And they had a separate graveyard like for the Chinese laborers.
Right, right, right. Yeah, total segregation even in death. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I mean, in some places you could see the calendar on the wall, like the day people left. And so all of these little clues started to just become very interesting to me. So when I heard about people going to North Dakota for the oil, I just was really curious if it had any of the same feeling. And if there was any, I kind of wanted to photograph it as well and then place these photographs next to these old mining towns or other industrial booms, and see if there were any notes of resonance. And so that's why I went out there.
And of course, once you got out there, you found that what an incredibly rich environment.
Yeah.
For a documentary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was instantly like bonded to the place.
What was what was the first thing you saw when you got to Williston?
The very first thing I did was I went down to the train station for no other reason but that I like trains. And I just couldn't believe what I saw on the platform. It was full of people. And this is a tiny whistle stop, or what used to be a whistle stop on the Empire Builder, which runs from Chicago all the way to Seattle. There were tons of people. There were whole families, you know, kids with all of their belongings, their pillows on their heads, husbands and wives kissing each other goodbye, just like these very raw, emotional kind of moments.
It's like almost like a Hollywood film in a way, the way, you know, the immigrants come to a new town, the latest stop on the railroad, and immediately come off. I mean, you have images that sort of remind you of this, except it's a 21st century image.
Exactly. It is like a Hollywood film. It is like some of the images you see from the migrations in the 1930s and 40s. And yet it's happening now, and it's very real. And so, you know, that sort of just instantly grabbed me. I couldn't believe it. And then the train rolled in, and all these big guys with sort of work boots and hard hats got off the train, and I just immediately heard all these accents from all over the country. And I just never heard that many different American accents. I mean, this is a real American migration. It's not very international. And I, you know, I mean, you can't stand like in a parking lot there, and there won't be two trucks next to each other with the same license plate. I mean, it'll be Alabama, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Missouri, Massachusetts, California, Utah. And it's really kind of incredible. And so that really grabbed me. And then the very first conversation I had right there on that train platform was so kind of raw and revealing that I instantly knew I had to start recording my conversations. Mm-hmm. And so then after that, I sort of carried my microphone with me everywhere. And anytime the conversation got interesting, I asked if I could record.
You've been making documentary film, and yet this project is stills and audio.
It really started in that same way that the whole project started, which is I was just sort of having fun out west, you know, traveling around these old abandoned mining towns. First of all, because it wasn't a job and I wasn't expecting it to be a project. And secondly, because it felt like a frozen moment in time or like a time capsule, I decided to just take photographs. And that was just for fun. And photography is something I've done over the course of my life on my days off. That's what I do. I wander around, take pictures. And when I'm working, I'm filming. So then I sort of had all these photographs, and that kind of seemed like the right medium for that particular journey that I was on. But then when I went to North Dakota, as I said, I kind of wanted to keep the medium the same, to see if anything sort of rose to the top when I put these sets of images next to each other. So, I mean, again, that's sort of the origin of the project. But once I started working in photography, I loved it so much better. So as intimate as filmmaking is, and it really is, I mean, documentary filmmaking, the kind that I do, and you're in incredible moments with people, you know, delicate, intense, you're in people's lives. But so as intimate as that is or was or has been for me, photography was even more intimate. And so I loved working with the medium. And as soon as I realized I could do sound as well and sort of do that separately, I just didn't need film. And honestly, I haven't gone back to it. I much prefer this. And I like breaking apart image and sound anyway, because they both have sort of their own textural strengths. And I don't feel like they have to be fixed in time or married to one another. I feel like they can have a relationship, but not one that makes you sit there and watch it one moment to the next.
Well, this area has such rich stories because you have this diaspora of people who are coming here for, you know, the idea of a boom town, get in while the getting's going, you know, and while you can make money. Probably most of them are aware it will not last, and they're there for the money, yet the town there has existed for a century or more. And I was looking at the census. For most of Williston's life, it's been around 10,000 people. It was around 10,000 people in 2000. By 2010, it had grown by 50%. And the estimate in 2015, it had grown by about 79%. And probably today, it's doubled or more in size. You know, how does a town like that handle this growth? And one of the things, your theme seems to be looking at how this town is reacting to becoming a boom town all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the town. It's really the whole region. That is, mm-hmm. Williston is the biggest town, but there's a lot of other little towns around there, Tioga, Ray. I mean, there's Watford City. There's really a lot of them. And then there's all the land in between the towns, which is where so much of the activity is as well. So, yeah, I mean, and the question, I mean, how do they even count people? Like, I would guess it had to be way more than double at the height of the boom. But I don't know how a census counts people who are so transient and not really living there or living in tents or coming and going, living in shipping
containers. Were there people actually living in tents? I know there were people living in RVs and things like that.
Oh, but yeah. RV was that was the rich version in the early days. Now, that's kind of before I got there. But yeah, initially people lived in tents. And, you know, the only big store there was Walmart, and they called it Tent City, and it was absolutely full. The entire parking lot were tents. And, I mean, the winters in North Dakota are cold, and sometimes you have people sharing, you know, three, four people in a tent. By the time I got there, the tents were gone. The city, actually, of Williston at some point sort of, like, outlawed them because there was crime and there were other issues that sort of came with it. But by the time I got there, everyone pretty much lived in these things that they call man camps. Now, that's their word for it. It's not my word for it. And man camps, they're basically shipping containers. They're converted shipping containers or connexes. They range from sort of these really big corporate-run ones like Target Logistics, where maybe they have 500, 1,000, 2,000 guys living on site and very, I mean, high security. No one can get in there who's not living there, et cetera, to sort of these makeshift, lots, really like company lots, where they just put some, you know, a company puts down a bunch of shipping containers for their guys. So everyone was really living in these man camps for years. It has started to shift. I mean, the developers finally started. The town itself was really slow to want to develop housing. And part of that is because they've had booms and busts in the past that were very ephemeral. They've built, I think they built a lot of housing in the 80s, and they knew there was oil there, but they couldn't get it. So everyone went home, and these houses sat there, and they all got black mold, and they had to be raised. So this time the town was really slow, and they were years slow. So by the time they actually started building, the price of oil was already going down. People were kind of already starting to leave, not completely. It's sort of in a middle ground now. But some people have moved into houses. Some people are still in these different lots. But your original question about how has the town itself responded, of course, that's a complicated question. But one thing that was just so interesting to see is, I mean, you're talking about a new industry in a place that's fairly remote. That's, you know, perhaps one of the reasons for the title Breaking Ground, because it's really kind of breaking ground on a new industry in this place. They had some oil in the past, but not a lot. Of course, the actual drilling for oil and fracking for it is also the process of breaking ground.
Sure.
But, you know, they just did not have the infrastructure to kind of to deal with this massive influx of people. And so, I mean, they're hauling oil down these tiny dirt roads, like these huge oil tankers. And I mean, just the dust alone for the first few years was incredible. It was probably the most toxic thing, actually. But, you know, so the state just, there was just a mad rush to like, and they got a lot of money. They got a lot of money from the oil money. And so suddenly, you know, they're paving roads. And another one of the photographs in here is of Williston, the town of Williston, breaking ground on a new high school. And in here, it's just a massive gaping hole with a bunch of snow and whatever and tubes and stuff coming out of it. But now it's this huge, unbelievably like beautiful high school. They have a huge trade school right next door. So, I mean, the town has definitely adjusted, but it certainly took time. And when I first got there, I mean, for example, like a perfect example is, what do people eat? You know, I mean, Walmart was kind of the only store, and that's where a lot of people got their food. And, you know, I mean, everyone was eating these TV dinners. There wasn't really refrigeration. Like, you'd walk into a big gas station or Walmart or something, and you'd see, like, just rows of, like, massive plastic cups full of big, huge chunks of salami and other meat. And this, you know, this is, you know, now you go into the Walmart there, and it's incredible what used to be these, you know, like rows of frozen food. Now they, you know, now it's just a small section in there, and they have organic vegetables, and they have other stuff in the Walmart, right in Williston.
Right.
So, but you know, restaurants, motels, all of that followed, but it took time.
I want to talk about some of the images that are in the show. You were talking about just the ability to get food. And one of the most striking images, I think, is this 24-hour self-service food kiosk. It looks like something you'd see on the streets of a major metropolitan area, except it's all by its lonesome. It's like nothing but prairie behind it. And it's just lit up bright as day. You take it the shot at twilight or right after twilight, at early dark. It's a really striking image. It gives you a sense of what this boom was all about.
Yeah, it's right in the middle of nowhere. I mean, that was probably, I only think that was probably about 20 miles south of Watford City. So it's in the middle of nowhere. And it's called Food Stand, because that is a stand with food. You know, basically it's like a vending machine, but for like hamburgers and sort of slightly heftier food that workers can get to in the middle of the night, or, you know, because people are working around the clock, of course, and they're out there, you know, they're living on site. If they're drilling, they're living on site.
One of the things also, not only are you showing what life is like for work, you're showing all the types of work. And that includes everything from nightlife, sex work as well. You show every side of what a boom is like.
Absolutely. I mean, it was important for me to show all the different kinds of work. I mean, there's the oil work, of course, and that's sort of the central industry. But then there's all the ancillary kinds of work that come along with it. There's laying the roads, there's building restaurants, there's plumbing, there's welding, there's everything. There's hauling the oil, there's the trains and trucks, of course, which is how they did it before the pipeline, was by train and truck. And then I wanted to show all other kinds of aspects of living as well. So it's the work, but it's the living. It's the people alone in their tiny little rooms. It's young families when women and young children are finally moving there, which again was a few years in. It's sort of that part of the migration. And the sex work, absolutely. Like, you know, I made a decision early on that I really wanted to include the sex work, and I really wanted to show it as work. Because that's what the women who were coming there early on, most of them were migrating there for sex work. I mean, whatever, strip clubs, prostitution, etc. And I feel like sex work is this thing that we often, we call it sex work, but we never show it as work. It's sort of alluded to, but never shown. And I felt like I kind of wanted to democratize the treatment of it and put it right alongside the oil rig work, because the truth is everyone is out there for money, and they're out there to work, and they're out there probably because they're pretty desperate, and they may or may not like their job. That isn't the point. No one's working there for a minute if they're not getting paid, and that's across the board.
My guest today is Valerie Lyman. She's a documentary artist, and Living Arts is presenting her really immersive documentary installation. I think that's the best way to describe it. It's called Breaking Ground, as a part of a group exhibition that's going on at Living Arts called Landscaping, and it's looking at how we use the land, how we community. There's all sorts of focuses, but Valerie's is on this major work she's been doing in the Bakken Shale region. And it's really immersive. This whole exhibition is, you're projecting these images on all sorts of everything from oil field equipment to packing crates to all sorts of things. I assume that these are things you saw on a regular basis in and around the Bakken area, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm taking this exhibition around different places in the country, and the way that I'm showing it, I've sort of spatialized it, right? Like, it's comprised of photographs and audio, but I want people to really sort of be able to wander around and explore different corners of this Bakken world at their own pace, whether that's the strip clubs or the man camps or the oil rig work, fracking, whatever. And so I wanted to spatialize it, but the reason that I'm actually projecting the photographs onto industrial remnants, and in this case, building equipment, building materials, is because I think there is some kind of, it sort of adds the element of time, right? I feel like this, what's happened in North Dakota has happened in many places in this country throughout its history. And, you know, people move to a place, you have a new industry, everyone moves in, everyone sort of lives hard, throws everything they have at the wall for a few years, and then more or less kind of, you know, maybe leaves settlement behind or just sort of moves on to the next place. And there's this sort of historical kind of echo at work there. And so I introduced the idea of time and of this being sort of the cyclical phenomenon by projecting the images onto older industrial remnants. And then I'm sort of blending the textures. It could be any time. I mean, those photographs are from the last 5 years, but it could be the past, it could be the present, it could be the future.
There's some corrugated metal in the exhibit, which that could have been used 100 years ago at one of those gold or silver camps.
Yeah. And all of those materials were collected in and around Tulsa in the last few weeks. And that was important to me, to find things from this area and from this area, either sort of active industry. I mean, some of these, the pallets I got from, you know, Midwest Manufacturing, and but yeah, to sort of use things that are from the area.
Well, indicative of a boomtown too, as well. Hmm. And what's really interesting is when you walk into the space, there's just a cacophony. There's a cacophony of images. There's a cacophony of these oral interviews that you've been doing. And it sort of gives you a sense of what a boomtown is like, because I think that's probably a good description of what these areas are like.
Exactly. It's all these voices and dreams sort of colliding in one place, you know, filling it up for a brief moment, lived all at once, very intensely. So the cacophony is important, because there's that idea of all these voices sort of clamoring in this one place. But I also want you to be able to have some intimacy and to be able to, I want it to be legible as well. And again, that's why I spatialize the audio. So you, as you walk around, you will hear a different mix of these voices. I'm dealing with the issues there of both echo and density. And again, that echo is, it's historical echo, it's oral echo, it's sort of the echo of what will be left, you know, when people move on, or when one of these boom towns is done, there is sort of this echo. And then there's visual echo. I'm projecting, you know, in some, the fracking piece, I've projecting images of fracking, which is this very sort of tubular, incredibly, you know, structurally intricate thing, onto propane tanks and other kinds of ductwork.
Gives this very three-dimensional sort of fragmented view. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's sort of pipes being laid upon pipes, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have to tell you, the interviews add so much to the images you're seeing in the exhibit, because you really had some amazing moments with a lot of these people that you're speaking with. It sounds like you had to get to know them for a while before they were willing to open up this way. There's one guy who talks about a century ago, it was like a covered wagon that was making his way across the plains. Now it's a pickup truck. That's our new covered wagon. Other people talking about, you know, I got here with $50 in my pocket. and I had to get a job immediately. It's just this really amazing story of, it's sort of very indicative of what America's going through for a lot of people in this country, that people are trying to understand what's going on in this country. I think going to this exhibit and hearing these voices could give people a lot of understanding about how desperate times are for a whole segment of our population, the people that are picking up everything they own, and maybe it's in the back of a pickup or in a suitcase, and getting on a train or driving the truck to Williston.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I hope that it can bring some of that kind of contact with that experience. I mean, these were people that I met out there who were pretty devastated by the 2008 recession and who didn't recover. Their lives didn't come back for one reason or the other. Most of these people had families. Most of them were sending the money back home. And this was their either their only chance or their best chance. And so, yes, I made very close friendships there, and I was there for a long time. And, you know, the first couple of times I was there, I stayed in motels, but that was really hard. Like, you had to book them a couple of weeks in advance. I mean, the Motel 6 was like, that was the cheapest place in town. It was like $135 or something a night. And you had to book it 2 weeks in advance. So, like, you couldn't exactly road trip it. But on my third time there, I actually had enough friends that I actually just moved into one of these man camps. And that's where I kind of lived every time I was there for the rest of the time. But, you know, one of the things that struck me so much about being there, and probably one of the reasons I kept going back, was because there was sort of this immediate connection that you would have with people. So a lot of those conversations were the first conversation that I had with that person. I didn't need to get to know them so well for them to share their lives with me, being all strangers in a strange land or something like that. There was this rawness and this connection, and sort of that kind of rawness of being, probably because people were working so hard, because life was so dangerous, because they were far away from home, because they were strangers. That's just something that I was really drawn to. And I think that shows up in the work for sure. But it wasn't always long relationships that necessarily produced those kind of intimate moments.
I was really struck by some of the images that you had in there. And I think you might have alluded to something along this, there's this frozen scene. And it looks like in the background they're building huge apartment blocks. Maybe this was the school going up, but I think it's the apartment blocks. They look like apartments in the background. You're showing a foreground view of trenches, you know, the infrastructure that's being dug in what looks like permafrost for this emerging apartment block. And it just gave me a sense, this is Siberia.
Yeah, well, that's the school, actually.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and but there is also a whole housing development being built there as well. But it does kind of feel like Siberia, and in a way, like, I like that. Like, that's what I like about it. There's something so interesting about the landscape, too. Like, there's this tundra that grows there, and it almost looks like Siberia or a desert or a cold desert. I mean, it also gets very hot there in the summer, but wow, in the winter,
yeah,
it is cold. I mean, you know, it was like my first winter there, it was minus 18 for, like, 3 weeks. It didn't get above that. So then you learn to deal with cold in a whole different way, which is also was interesting for me.
Another image you alluded to this earlier was the boy coming off the train. You know, it's like, okay, you're bringing your family to this boomtown. You know, I mean, to me, that's I understand why it would happen, but it was like, here's this boy, he's coming off the train. He's got his pillow propped on top of his head, like he's probably been sleeping on a 25-30 hour train ride to this place. And it's a very poignant photograph.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and in that case, I don't know if that was so early on, and I don't know if he was coming to live there or if they were just visiting. Mm-hmm. But in any case, you know, there are these separations, and a lot of people really didn't want to bring their families there at first. They were scared of bringing their families, whether it was their kids or their wives or whatever. And so they lived with these painful separations for long times, I mean, years. It was kind of, and that was another thing, it was just so moving and kind of, you know, amazing. Like, I would walk up to, I don't know, the biggest, like, oiliest guy that I could, you know, imagine and, you know, ask him one question about his family and he'd start crying. Mm. Like, it was that raw.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were Skyping, they were calling home, they were doing whatever they could do. And in many cases, these people had young children and that's why they were so desperate to support them. So in that particular case, I don't know if that boy was living there or if he was just visiting. But what struck me was interesting. That's actually one of the first pictures I ever took there. It's that same moment that I told you where this entire scene was just searing into me. And that is on the first roll that I took there. And I remember it was something about his eyes. It was the way he was looking off. And I walked up to him and I just asked him if I could take a picture. And his mom was there too. And I asked her as well, because I think when you're taking pictures of children, you should. But the funny thing was he never engaged me. He said yes, but he never even looked at me, and he's not looking at me in the photograph either. He just kept exactly what he was doing. It was so interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's a powerful exhibit. It's titled Breaking Ground. It's on display at Living Arts. Some powerful stories being told by the people who are participating in this boom, and you just have to wonder what's going to happen down the road for that area. Will it survive? Will it? Obviously, it's going to change at some point once everything plays out, just like every other boom has happened in our history. What's your thoughts?
It's interesting. I was back there in November and December of this past year. So what happened was, once the price of oil sort of plummeted a few years ago, a lot of companies shuttered. A lot of these people got laid off. It was just people, and the ones that were there were just barely hanging on by a thread. And that lasted a good 2 to 3 years. So the whole place got, you know, it kind of busted out, but not completely. And it was interesting because when I first started this, I knew, you know, well, one day, whether it's 10 years from now or 100, the oil boom in North Dakota will be over, right? And that's why I was sort of thinking of it through this historical lens to begin with. But I didn't expect it to happen that fast. And already in my exhibit, you know, I've included a bunch of photographs of abandoned housing, you know, oil drills that they just laid down in the fields and walked away from them. What's interesting about it now is because the price of oil has gone back up or is going back up, it's alive. It's not booming, and I don't think it ever will boom again the way it did. And, you know, there's something about that that's just sort of breaking ground in a new industry, resources, infrastructure, people rushing in kind of from all directions. These couple years, I think, have given people, by people, I mean, you know, companies sort of the time to catch their breath and really think about how they're going to organize themselves moving forward. And there was no time to do that before. There was just way too much money to be made.
I was struck by one of the oral histories there, the oral statements. The guy says, you know, this must be what it must have been like in 49 in California. And he says, there's no way I was going to miss it.
Right. Yeah, that was someone who came in and then opened up a whole bunch of restaurants there. But there's other people who said that. Everyone sort of had that consciousness about themselves, even the people who lived in the town. There was one guy I was talking to who had this motel. I mean, he had this motel in his family line for 3 generations probably, and probably barely made any money off of it. Now suddenly it's just this booming thing. And, you know, his 10-year-old daughter is helping him run it. But he said the same thing, like, this is, you know, this is like 49 or something. But he kind of also knew that people were going to leave. But what will happen there, I don't know. There's no way to impose a narrative on it. I felt like there were many fewer people there now, but the ones that were there were more well off. That was the general feeling I had. And it's interesting to see how money changes a place over time. Seeing that high school built, seeing these roads, seeing all these kind of new facilities, people are growing up there in a different town than was there 10 years ago. And the people who are staying, engineers, you know, it's sort of almost a little bit more of a middle class, not completely. I mean, it's still pretty working class, but it has both now. And before it didn't.
Fascinating installation, Breaking Ground, on display at Living Arts. Valerie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Documentary artist Valerie Lyman speaking with me back in May here on Studio Tulsa when her exhibit Breaking Ground first opened. It's part of a group exhibition at Living Arts of Tulsa titled Landscaping, Development Community Effect, which closes this evening. And the exhibit closes with an artist talk by Lyman. She'll be speaking this evening at 7 o'clock at Living Arts of Tulsa. Details on the event available at livingarts.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.